want the Republicans to wake up is the Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to do it live.
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
I am humbled and grateful for the support of people who subscribe to this program, like Michael Powell, David Radcliffe, Peter Ober, and Julia Fung. You can do it too. Just go to peterbcollins.com, and our free bonus book offer continues for new subscribers. The details are on the homepage at peterbcollins.com.
Hear ye! Hear ye! The court's in session. The court's in session. Now, here come the judge. Here come the judge.
Here come the judge!
All rise in the presence of the Honorable Catherine B. Forrest, the United States District Court, New York. On Wednesday, May 16, Judge Catherine B. Forrest issued a ruling putting an injunction on the enforcement of a section of the National Defense Authorization Act that I have been fuming about since last December when I first saw it as proposed legislation, and then it made me doubly angry when the president signed it with a signing statement saying that while he wouldn't use it, he was still going to permit it to become law. And at issue is Section 1021, which, in its most extreme interpretation, would allow any American citizen who is accused of some remote connection to terrorists or a terrorist act to be held without charge or trial indefinitely. Carl Mayer is an attorney and part of the legal team that pressed the case on behalf of journalists like Chris Hedges and others, and Daniel Ellsberg and Noam Chomsky were also plaintiffs in this case. And as I like to mention, Carl also represents me in a class action suit aimed at preserving our Fourth Amendment rights and protecting us from government surveillance in the form of wiretapping and other eavesdropping that I believe is flatly unconstitutional. Carl, as always, it's great to talk with you.
Thank you. It's an honor. It's an honor to be on again with the legendary Peter B. Collins. Thank you very much for having me on the show.
Well, legendary status goes to you and your colleagues for bringing this suit and prevailing. And I mentioned when Pigmeat Martin was singing there that we should all rise. And I am standing right now in support of your standing to bring this case because I thought it was going to be dismissed and that the government would simply say that the plaintiffs have no basis to bring this case because they can't show they have been harmed. But Judge Forrest, in a 68-page ruling, went to great pains to show that your plaintiffs presented what was considered undisputed testimony of the harm that this provision can cause them.
Yes, that's right. It demonstrates, this ruling yesterday demonstrates the importance of always fighting until the last bell, because there was a boatload of legal pundits who were willing to say this suit was going to fail, didn't have a chance, wasn't going anywhere, naysaying us, but we prevailed, and it really is not so much a testament to our own work, although today we think we're pretty bad men.
Uh-huh. Good. Good. Because, you know,
we're entitled to think we're pretty bad men for one day anyway.
Well,
but
Carl,
it really is a testament to Judge Forrest, who wrote a very important us a very intricate, very soundly reasoned and sober opinion that I think would is going to withstand scrutiny at whatever level, including up at the Supreme Court. She really she did everything that an Article III federal judge should do. She more than did her homework. She really dug into this case, really ferreted out the facts on her own, in addition to the facts that the plaintiff supplied. And the net result is that the NDAA has been enjoined. It is in effect no longer. The most onerous provision, which was Section 1021, which would have permitted the Obama administration and future administrations to hold in military prisons indefinitely without right to trial or counsel American citizens, this ruling has ensured that will no longer be. It's just, I would say it is a large and historic and important victory, and really the credit goes to Judge Forrest and to the very brave and courageous plaintiffs. We call them the Freedom Seven. They were Christopher Hedges, the Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, Daniel Ellsberg, who the legendary whistleblower and author of the Pentagon Papers, who's still at it at 81 years of age.
He's amazing.
He's still at it. Resident of the Bay Area. I want to give a shout out to Dr. Ellsberg in Oakland, I believe. He was joined by Birgitta Jónsdóttir, who is a member of Iceland's parliament, and she was a plaintiff because she had worked with WikiLeaks, and because of her work with WikiLeaks, the U.S. government, even though she's a foreign parliamentarian, had subpoenaed her Twitter account and her other personal accounts. The Icelandic foreign minister had told her she couldn't, had advised her not to fly to the United States because of the subpoena. And the attempt by the U.S. government to intimidate her for being involved with WikiLeaks.
Well, Carl, wait till Scalia gets a hold of that. You know, having a European testify and be a plaintiff in an American case.
Well, I think even Scalia is going to understand the scope of the statute was overreaching because it provided for detention of people around the world, whether in the not just in the United States, whether United States citizens or not. So the statute itself opened up the door for non-U.S. citizens to be plaintiffs. And frankly, the way that the government has treated a foreign democratically elected official of a coalition ally and partner is, I think, entirely inappropriate. And one of the many reasons that we're calling on the Obama administration and have been since Judge Forrest issued the preliminary injunction to come out forcefully and say that they will not appeal this ruling, that they will abide by a permanent injunction, and that they will not attempt, nor will the Congress attempt, to resurrect the NDAA. Because, no matter how you slice it, this effort to, in effect, put American citizens and residents into the military justice system instead of the civilian justice system, that's unconstitutional.
Mm-hmm. And, Carl, let me just ask you and the seven to take one more bow. Humility is overrated, particularly at a time like this. And I would like you to enjoy a big smile as I read you this citation from Glenn Greenwald's column at Salon today. Though I knew a fair amount about it as it proceeded, I hadn't written about this lawsuit before, largely because I did not expect it to succeed. I anticipated that it would be dismissed on standing grounds, the favored tactic along with the state secrets privilege for both the Bush and Obama DOJ's Departments of Justice to persuade federal courts not to even adjudicate constitutional challenges to the War on Terror powers. Serious kudos to all the plaintiffs and lawyers here who persevered in what I'm certain they knew would be an uphill battle.
Right. Well, we definitely appreciate those comments from Glenn Greenwald, who was himself a constitutional litigator and now and now writer, and a very important early writer about the dangers of the NDAA. So we certainly appreciate his long work, and you know, your long work on exposing the dangers of the NDAA. If it weren't for the type of reporting that you do and Glenn Greenwald does, the dangers of this would not have gotten out there. But you know, I want to make sure the audience knows too that in addition to Ellsberg and Ms. Jónsdóttir, the Icelandic parliamentarian, and Christopher Hedges, there were some young activists who were involved in this case.
Like Alexa O'Brien,
who was the founder of a group called U.S. Day of Rage. Like Tangerine Boland, who was the founder of a group called Revolution Truth. Like Kai Wargala, who was one of who helped start the Occupy London movement. These people are all an example of how the younger generation doesn't just want to settle for politics as usual. They want to get involved. They want to not just make a difference, but fight with everything they have for justice. So it was really impressive that they were standing along with the older generation going back to Daniel Ellsberg. And it was nice to see that continuum in the Freedom 7.
Indeed.
For example, Kai Wargala, after founding or helping to found Occupy London, it turned out that Occupy London was dubbed by the London police to be a terrorist organization, if you can believe it. Right next, in a report, they were pegged right next to Al-Qaeda as a terrorist organization. Alexa O'Brien, who founded U.S. Day of Rage, was a movement it was nonviolent, but devoted to campaign finance reform, and they actually did the nonviolent training for the Occupy Wall Street folks. And there were numerous memos that came out whereby defense contractors working with the FBI tried to link U.S. Day of Rage and Alexa O'Brien to Islamic fundamentalist groups, even though there was no evidence of that. So it really is an astounding development.
Well, Carl, I want to thank, I believe he's a mutual friend of ours, Kevin Zeis, who is an attorney and an activist on so many fronts. He's one of the leaders of Occupy Washington. He sent out a press release today that included an attachment, which is the judge's 68-page ruling. And I've had a chance to breeze through it. I have some questions for you, but I'm also going to link in the show file at Peter B. Collins to this judge's ruling so that people can evaluate it for themselves. I was really struck by her thoroughness and by the credibility that she extended to the testimony of those plaintiffs who did testify, and by the failure of the government to provide any meaningful challenge to that testimony.
Yeah, I think the opinion was very cleverly written. That is one fact that's very important to this case. The other fact is that the Obama administration has been every bit as ham-handed and clumsy as the Congress in going down this road of trying to militarize the U.S. justice system. And frankly, I think it's shameful for a president who is a former constitutional law scholar and campaigned on being a civil libertarian to engage in this. And they made the administration made a couple of critical litigation errors. First of all, they didn't call any witnesses at the trial we held in Federal District Court in Manhattan. They wouldn't put on any witnesses who could have explained why, for example, it was important to have these provisions of the NDAA or why it was defensible or it could have been narrowly construed, but no witnesses. That was their number one decision. But the most devastating part of what happened with the government is when Judge Forrest cross-examined herself, the government's attorneys, and repeatedly asked them, can you give assurances to these journalists, to these activists, to these writers, to Noam Chomsky, to Daniel Ellsberg, that they will not be prosecuted under the NDAA? And time after time after time, the answer was, we cannot give such assurances. We cannot give such assurances. As soon as the government made those representations in court, it was game over, because at that point under applicable law, it's reasonable for the plaintiffs to fear prosecution under the NDAA, and that gives them standing. And that's why the opinion was so not just thorough, but based on a very comprehensive record.
Carl, I think I know the answer to what I'm about to ask, but I think it needs to be asked.
Yeah.
As I read the ruling, the government's efforts related to this case really qualify for the term lame. And the judge didn't use that word, but in, you know, the official language of the court, dinged the government for undisputed testimony. I mean, that's a direct hint that, gosh, all you had to do is walk in here and show me some cause, and I might not be granting this injunctive relief. Did the Obama administration lay down on this? And would it be, if that's the case, because you so narrowly targeted the single section 1021 of the Homeland Battlefield bill that was rolled up into the NDAA?
Well, it's hard to understand what the administration's intent was. If there was ever a time for the president to be a person of his word, to be a civil libertarian, it would be now, in which he would state that he's read the considered opinion of Judge Forrest. He's willing to enter into a permanent injunction and not appeal this. And if the administration were to do that, that would send a signal, I think, that in fact they didn't want to fight this that hard. But I can't say that that's the case. I don't know what their strategy was. It may be that they thought that, like many legal commentators suggested, that we weren't going to prevail because of the standing issues,
mm-hmm.
and they just took it for granted. So I don't know what their thinking was, other than to say that strategically and tactically, the administration did not put on a good case, and it wasn't mm-hmm. the fault of the particular lawyers who did it, because they were actually very competent counsel. It's just their client didn't show up. 90% of life is showing up. They didn't show up.
Now, Carl, one of the arguments extended by the government mm-hmm. was that this, what we find offensive, section 1021, was simply an affirmation of the language in the post 9/11 authorization for the use of military force. The judge rejected that contention, mm-hmm. but that appeared to be the major thrust of the government in trying to dodge your suit.
Yes, and they're trying to do a sleight of hand. It's like a three card Monte game. The government was trying to say, oh well, the authorization for the use of military force that was passed back in 2001, right after the 9/11 attacks, and we're not going beyond that. All we're doing is the same thing we're authorized to do by the AUMF. And that is complete and utter nonsense, complete red herring, and the judge was buying none of it for two reasons. First, the authorization for the use of military force passed in 2001 targeted only people who were specifically involved in the attacks of 9/11, or members of Al-Qaeda, period. In other words, people who had committed violent acts against the United States. The NDAA, by contrast, targeted almost the whole world. Anyone who gave, quote, substantial support to Al-Qaeda or, quote, associated forces, that could mean anything. It could encompass almost anyone. Anyone who, you know, ever wrote an opinion saying, the Muslim Brotherhood provides social services to people could be considered to be giving substantial support to Al-Qaeda or associated forces.
Mm-hmm.
So totally different animals. The AUMF was narrowly targeted, and the NDAA was, as we learned yesterday, constitutionally overbroad and vague.
And one of the areas where the judge spent some time in her ruling relates to the lack of a definition of the phrase that you just used, and associated forces. And, for example, it's very hard for me to know if the group that the CIA calls AQAP, Al-Qaeda on the Arabian Peninsula, is in fact in any way connected to the Al-Qaeda that is referenced in the authorization for use of military force, and then by stipulation, at least by the government's argument, into this Section 1021 of the NDAA. I don't think there's any proof that there is a direct connection. And if we are to believe the selective release of documents that allegedly came from Abbottabad, Pakistan, and the last domicile of Osama bin Laden, he objected to any connection between his group and those in Yemen. So, I mean, that's just one example of how this phrase, associated forces, it remains undefined. And the judge even pointed out that in the following section, 102.2, which relates to non-citizens, that there were lengthy definitions of the terminology. But in 1021, there was not even an attempt to define associated forces.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it was, it truly was a stellar opinion. She hit the nail on the head, which is that the government can define associated forces any way they want to. In the State Department's list of terrorist groups, of which Chris Hedges has reported personally on about 17, you know, Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula is named, but there are dozens of other groups, and there's a whole other group of affiliated groups. So, the government could define associated forces any way it wanted to, just as they could define substantially supported associated forces any way they wanted to, and that's why it was vague and overbroad. I can't say enough about what Judge Forrest did, because I think that the type of action she took is what the American people want. They want their leaders to stand on principle and conviction and get the job done. It would have been so easy for her to pass the buck upstairs to the appellate court, to not rule, to not issue an injunction, to put it off. You know yourself, Peter B., from the litigation over the warrantless wiretapping, that's been going up and down the courts. We've been going up and down the courts for 6 years on this now.
Yeah.
And so, you know, the appellate courts issue a good ruling, but they don't stop what the administration is doing. Where's the injunction? Finally, we got an injunction. Finally, we got someone who said, enough is enough. I'm going to exercise my power under the Constitution as an independent federal judge. That's what the people want, and they got it. And I think they want more of it. So I hope Judge Forrest, fellow brethren in the judiciary, take heed.
Well, I certainly do too. Now, Carl, as I read the ruling, since I didn't go to law school like you, there are a few things that I need some explaining, if you could assist just a little bit.
Sure thing.
One has to do with the nature of facial, finding something, I guess, on the face of it to be unconstitutional. So can you explain, because she said that your challenge to 1021 is likely to succeed on a facial challenge, and I believe that's based on the First Amendment.
Mm-hmm. That's correct. There are two types of constitutional challenges you could make. One is a facial challenge, meaning that the very language of the statute is so broad and so violative of the First Amendment that on its face, the entire statute has to be struck down. Another type of challenge to a statute could be an as-applied statute, an as-applied challenge. So the judge could have ruled that the way that the NDAA was applied specifically to these seven plaintiffs would have been unconstitutional just as applied to them. And she didn't go for that. And that would have been a much more narrow opinion. It would have been more conservative. It would have been the safe option, and she didn't take the easy route out. And you know, you find in life that usually the easy route is not the best way to go. It's the hard way to go that you have to take. And to her credit, she took it, because it's a much more sweeping opinion, and it throws out that entire section of 1021. You know, she could have just ruled that the statute, as applied to particular journalists like Hedges, who covers Al-Qaeda, or Ellsberg, who was involved with WikiLeaks, that the statute was unconstitutional as to them. But she ruled, no, it's unconstitutional as to everyone. And frankly, she's 100% correct.
Now, Carl, she was, I would call it, full-throated in speaking to the encroachment on the First Amendment rights of the plaintiffs. And she did allow that the infringement might be unintentional, but it is real. And that was sufficient for her to find in your favor on the First Amendment. Now, when I read the part about the Fifth Amendment, which of course requires a due process before life or liberty can be taken, I got a little bit confused there because it appears she pulled up short and didn't actually rule on a Fifth Amendment infringement, saying that the First Amendment was sufficient. And so can you explain that to me? And from your point of view going forward to potential appeals, would it have been better if she had found on both elements of the Bill of Rights, 1 and 5, as opposed to framing this primarily on the First Amendment?
No, I think actually this case does come down to the First Amendment primarily. I think she did rule what lawyers would call in dicta, meaning she didn't make the Fifth Amendment ruling per se, but as an aside, she suggested that the Fifth Amendment and due process requires that plaintiffs like the ones here who are journalists and activists, that they have, as a matter of due process, that they're entitled to a more specific law that tells them when and where their liberties could be impinged upon.
Mm-hmm.
And that wasn't present here. So she didn't go so far as to also hang her hat on the Fifth Amendment, but she did mention it in dicta. And frankly, I think she was smart to really focus on the First Amendment because, as we had discussed earlier, the Citizens United case, which I don't happen to agree with because of the corporate personhood issue, but it's a very strong First Amendment opinion, and the Supreme Court has strong First Amendment views. And what she's saying is what's good for the goose is good for the gander. If you're going to accord corporations very expansive First Amendment rights, including the right to spend money on elections, then you damn well better be expansive when you apply First Amendment rights to journalists and activists and ordinary citizens. And
yes,
I think that was a smart way of doing it.
You and I discussed that reference to Citizens United before we started recording this conversation, Carl.
Mm-hmm.
And I found it quite unusual here on page 49. In Citizens United, Justice Kennedy wrote that speech is an essential mechanism of democracy, for it is the means that holds officials accountable to the people. The right of citizens to inquire, to hear, to speak, and to use information to reach consensus is a precondition to enlightened self-government. Now, this is the first positive use of Citizens United that I have seen since this ugly decision was rendered.
Yes. Yeah. It, you know, even... Even I suppose even an abomination has a day in the sun. So yeah, largely is an abomination because it focuses on two fictions: the fiction that a corporation is a person, and the fiction that money is a speech. And it relies on those fictions to expand the First Amendment rights. And what I think she's doing is, in her opinion, Judge Forrest is very clever. She is targeting Justice Kennedy, who is a swing vote.
Yep.
Sometimes.
Yep.
And in so doing, she is trying to protect her opinion up on appeal. And that's what makes it a very, very clever opinion.
And let me just echo...
As one of the Twitter commentaries said in reporting on the on Judge Forrest's opinions, "You go, girl. You go, girl. Go, Judge Forrest." So there was a lot of very positive reaction to what they did, and the general public, I think, has a hugely positive reaction, and I think there are a lot of civil liberties lawyers that that appreciate the brilliance of her writing.
Now, is there some, like a trade website or paper that judges use? Because what you're describing here in Judge Forrest's opinion, with the explicit reference to Citizens United, aimed at Justice Kennedy, I mean, he's even named, this echoes what Judge Walker, Vaughn Walker, did here in San Francisco before he retired, when he ruled on the El Haramain charity case, which was the one wiretapping case to date where standing was found, a judgment was entered, and damages were awarded to the plaintiffs.
Mm-hmm.
And in that case, Judge Walker, according to John Eisenberg, the attorney for the plaintiffs, very cleverly wrote the opinion, A, without using any secret information, and B, it was explicitly aimed at Justice Kennedy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it's very similar to that, and very well crafted, and I think it stands a good chance of holding up. I just can't imagine that the Obama administration wants to go through an appeal process here. They have to decide within 60 days. They have a 60-day limit in order to file an appeal. And if they do decide to appeal this opinion, there's going to be a whole another round of condemnation from left, right, and center, Democrats, Republicans, and independents about how un-American and fundamentally reactionary this administration is when it comes to national security issues. So I think the administration ought to just knock it off and recognize that it's wholly unconstitutional, call it a day, and go home.
Well, that'd be nice. I tend to doubt it, but we will see if there is some turning of the page, as the candidate Obama used to say so often.
That's right.
One other factor here that asks for a little explanation, Carl, is that the judge cited that in reference to Section 121, which she has now granted an injunction of, that there was no implementation directive. Now, the law required, and I guess policy and process require, that following this kind of a new piece of legislation, that there is on the onus of the executive branch a requirement to produce an implementation directive. And the judge noted that there were implementation directives that were issued around March 1st, at about the time the law actually took effect, that essentially enable the implementation of many sections of it. But she explicitly noted that there was no implementation directive for Section 1021.
Yeah, and again, that was clever reasoning on her part. The 1022, for example, is the section that deals with foreign combatants and members of Al-Qaeda and other terrorist groups directly, actual members or people who take up arms. And there were all sorts of directives and policy requirements that were issued by the administration. To tell you the truth, I think the administration was simply trying to be, as they say, too cute by half by not issuing the policy. They wanted to keep it vague. And frankly, the administration, I believe, wanted to keep it vague as to who would be targeted under Section 1021, because that would give them the ability to not only chill the speech of a lot of journalists and activists who write in this area, but to target whomever they wanted. And it could vastly expand executive power, which executives are always wont to do. That was a glaring invitation to litigation, and we took it.
Mm-hmm. Now, Carl,
thank you very much.
One other term here that was new to me is, I think it's pronounced scienter, and I believe it refers to whether an individual knowingly engages in the prohibited behavior. Can you explain that term and how pivotal it is in this decision?
Right. Well, the concept of scienter is mostly a criminal law concept. The issue is whether there is a knowing engagement in a type of activity that is prescribed. And here, there wasn't any definition of or requirement of scienter, of knowingly aiding terrorists. It just said substantially supported terrorists. So, for example, somebody could have written an article about, say, the Muslim Brotherhood, and even though writing the article was intended just to report facts, if it had the unintended consequence of helping a terrorist group, as defined by the U.S. government, that person could be caught up under the NDAA. There was no requirement that that person have scienter, meaning that they have the intent to help a terrorist group or Al-Qaeda.
Right.
So that was another huge defect in the statute.
And Carl, when you and I last spoke in January, I disclosed to you, under the attorney-client privilege with just a few people listening in, that I had purchased a T-shirt from the Gaza Freedom Flotilla crew.
Mm-hmm.
And they have, in turn, been designated by a resolution of Congress as terrorists, and their efforts to peacefully travel to Gaza and to break the Israeli blockade have been described as by our government as terrorists. And so, based on before Judge Forrest's decision, it appears that I was vulnerable under the very broad and undefined language of Section 1021, simply for buying a T-shirt in support of a group that has been inappropriately designated as terrorist.
Right, and that is an excellent example of how a journalist doing their job or an activist being involved in the cause, or both, could get swept up in a law that would put them in military detention without right to trial by jury or right to counsel. And that is an abrogation of 200 years of American legal precedent, dating back really to, there's a case called Ex Parte Milligan that was decided shortly after the Civil War, which held that a U.S. citizen could not be tried in a military tribunal, before military tribunal, even though they were advocating the overthrow of, for example, the government of Indiana during the time of the Civil War, because they were segregationist sympathizers.
Mm-hmm.
So again, it established a very important precedent, and even equally important, Peter B., we want to do our best to keep you out of the brig for buying T-shirts that you're not supposed to be buying.
So, well, thank you.
You keep our number on speed dial, because we marched into federal court and we gave it to the federal government on their home turf. So keep us on speed dial in case you get in trouble again, right?
Well, I really appreciate that, because I like to point out to people that I've been in San Quentin over 100 times, but I've never been invited to spend the night. And I feel the same way about Guantanamo. I would be not pleased, but willing to visit, but I don't want to spend a night there in the clink.
Right. Well, we're doing our best to see that doesn't happen.
Well, Carl, I want to thank you and congratulate you on this issue. Take a moment to tell us about the other effort that you're working on to extend the decision of the Supreme Court of the state of Montana overturning the application of the Citizens United decision in the Big Sky State.
Right. I'll put in a couple plugs here. For the first, for your listeners who want to get involved in the litigation, and there may be an appeal over the NDAA, they can go to stopndaa.org, at stopndaa.org, and learn more about the litigation, help contribute, work on the appeal fund, whatever they want to do or get involved. The second case that the Mayer Law Group is involved in here, and people can reach us at the website carlmayer.com, that's carlmayer.com, is also ambitious and also not given a likelihood of success, but that never deters us. The second case involves a challenge to the onerous Citizens United case that we were just talking about, and that challenge is based on a recent opinion by the Supreme Court of the state of Montana, which in which the court came out on the exact opposite side of Citizens United. The court defended a Montana statute that bars corporations from contributing to political elections in Montana,
mm-hmm.
and attempted to distinguish the situation from that discussed in Citizens United by pointing to the long history of corruption in Montana and how these laws are necessary if you're ever going to have a democratic process that works. So, of course, the Chamber of Commerce and the business interests immediately filed a petition asking the Supreme Court to reverse Montana's decision, and we're involved there with a group that's a terrific group. It's called the 11th Amendment Movement, or a team, and listeners can just Google team or go to the 11thAmendment.org website. That group is putting in a brief, which we're doing, to ask the Supreme Court not to take the cert petition and to let the ruling in Montana stand. And that would have the effect of allowing the states to regulate their elections
mm-hmm.
and keep the corporate money out of politics, even though Citizens United has to do with federal elections. So that's another it's another big challenge for us, but we like big challenges.
Well, Carl, you're working on all the right issues, and I support your efforts 100%. I'd ratchet up even further, but, you know, it just doesn't work over 100%. So congrats to you and to your team. Give my best to the plaintiffs, including Chris Hedges, who during the last 2 years has really risen to become a major force in American politics and, I believe, a conscience for all of us on the battle against corporate power. And to see this victory on his behalf and that of the other plaintiffs is something that really makes me feel good, Carl.
Well, I'm delighted, Peter B., because you know, we're inspired by you know, plaintiffs like yourself in the warrantless wiretapping litigation and the journalists who not only ferret out the truth but have strong opinions on what's right and what's wrong and what's in the interest of people and democracy. And you're a leader in that category. So thank you so much for everything you do, and thank you for having me on.
My pleasure. Carl Mayer, one of the attorneys for the case that resulted in the injunction. And just for fun, let me go to page 68 of the ruling here and read the judge's final statement. For the aforementioned reasons, plaintiff's motion for preliminary injunction is granted. Enforcement of Section 1021 of the NDAA is preliminarily enjoined pending further order of this court or amendments to the statute rendering this opinion and order moot. Ah, that feels really good. Carl Mayer, we'll talk to you again very soon.
Sweeter words have rarely been penned. Thank you, Peter B.
Well, friends, the Constitution is not dead yet. Thanks for listening. Send me an email.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.